This content is AI-generated for informational purposes only and should not be directly used for clinical decision-making.
Hello, and welcome back to the Neurosurgery Hub podcast. I'm Dr. Aris, Senior Attending in Neurosurgery.
And I'm Dr. Alara, Research Fellow. Today, we're looking at a fascinating new study from the journal Neurosurgical Review, published in early 2026. It's a contemporary series focused on transsphenoidal microsurgery in pediatric patients.
This is a crucial topic, Alara. When we talk about cellar lesions, the pediatric population is a completely different world compared to our adult patients. We're dealing with a developing skull base, a shifting endocrine landscape, and frankly, much rarer pathologies. In most centers, these make up less than 10% of all childhood brain tumors.
Exactly. And this study by Stephanie Ott and her team at the medical center Hamburg-Eppendorf gives us a really deep look into this. They analyzed a decade's worth of data from 2013 to 2023, covering 147 transsphenoidal surgeries on 122 pediatric patients. What's particularly impressive is that all these were performed by a single surgeon, Dr. Jörg Fletch.
That single surgeon factor is vital for a study like this because it eliminates the variable of different surgical hands and techniques. It allows us to really focus on the patient's anatomy and the pathology itself. So, Alara, looking at their cohort, what were the primary entities they were treating?
It was quite a mix, but the big two were craniopharyngiomas and pituitary adenomas, or PITNETs, as we're increasingly calling them. Craniopharyngiomas were the most common overall, at about 34.4%, followed closely by adenomas at 31%. But here's the interesting part. The distribution was heavily age-dependent.
Right, the 10-year rule we often see in clinical practice.
Exactly. In children under 10, craniopharyngiomas were the dominant force, representing nearly 59% of cases. Once you get over that 10-year-old threshold, the PITNETs start to take over. And unlike adults where we see a lot of non-functional adenomas, the pediatric adenomas were mostly secreting. Corticotrophic adenomas, Cushing's disease, and prolactinomas were the front runners.
That's a key point for the residents listening. If a 14-year-old presents with a cellar mass, your suspicion for a functioning adenoma should be much higher than in a 55-year-old. But let's talk about the surgical challenge. Why is the transsphenoidal approach so much more technically demanding in a child?
It really comes down to the corridor. The study highlights three major anatomical hurdles: the smaller midface, the narrow intercarotid distance, and most importantly, the sphenoid sinus pneumatization.
And that pneumatization is a moving target, isn't it?
It is. The authors remind us that the sphenoid bone only starts to pneumatization around 10 months of age. It really accelerates between ages 3 and 6, but it doesn't actually finish until the late third decade of life. The study found a direct inverse correlation between the degree of sphenoid pneumatization and the duration of the surgery.
That makes perfect sense. If you have a conchal or precellar type of sphenoid, you're spending a significant amount of your surgical time just drilling bone before you even see the dura. Did the study quantify that time difference?
They did. The 3 to 9-year-old age group had the longest surgical durations. As the patients got older, specifically in the 16 to 17-year-old range, the surgeries became significantly faster because the sphenoid sinus was better developed, providing an easier natural corridor.
I think it's worth noting that while many centers have moved entirely to the endoscopic endonasal approach, this series utilized microsurgery and 3D video microscopy. In the pediatric population, where the nasal corridor is so narrow, the microscope can sometimes offer advantages in terms of instrument maneuverability compared to having multiple instruments in an endoscope in a tiny nostril.
That's a great point, Dr. Aris. The authors mentioned that despite the anatomical constraints, they didn't report any major carotid injuries or permanent neurological deficits related to the approach itself. However, they did track postoperative complications closely.
What did the post-op landscape look like for these kids?
As we might expect with cellar surgery, the endocrine system is the most volatile area. Arginine vasopressin disorder, what we used to call diabetes insipidus, and SIAD were the most common issues. They also looked at new pituitary insufficiencies and CSF leaks. Given that a third of these were craniopharyngiomas, which are notoriously adherent to the hypothalamus and the stalk, those endocrine challenges are almost par for the course.
And craniopharyngiomas also have a higher recurrence rate, which usually leads to repeat surgeries. Did the study address the redo cases?
Yes, they had 25 patients who required repeat surgery. This is where the transsphenoidal route is so beneficial. It allows for a direct path back to the cella without the morbidity of a repeat craniotomy, even in children.
Let's pivot to the clinical presentation. For the medical students listening, how were these children actually presenting to the clinic?
It was a broad spectrum.
Growth arrest and delayed puberty were very common because of the hormonal disruptions. Then you have the classic visual disturbances from chiasmal compression. But in the younger kids, the symptoms were often more nonspecific, headaches or just general failure to thrive until imaging was finally ordered.
This brings up the importance of the multidisciplinary team. You can't treat pediatric cellar lesions without a rock-solid pediatric endocrinologist and a neuro-ophthalmologist. The surgery is just one piece of the puzzle.
Absolutely. The authors emphasize that preoperative planning is everything. You have to look at the MRI and CT scans not just for the tumor, but to map out that sphenoid sinus. If you're going into a five-year-old with a contral sphenoid, you need to be prepared for a long, meticulous bone drilling phase before you even reach the pathology.
If you were to summarize the take-home message of this 10-year series for a resident preparing for their first pediatric transsphenoidal case, what would it be?
I'd say three things. First, age dictates pathology. Think craniopharyngioma in the young and secreting pit nets in the teens. Second, anatomy is a developmental work in progress. The sphenoid sinus is your biggest technical hurdle, and its state of pneumatization will directly predict your time in the OR. And third, despite the small corridors and narrow intercarotid distances, the transsphenoidal microsurgical approach is remarkably safe and effective when performed by an experienced surgeon.
Well said. It's also a reminder that pediatric isn't a single category. A 4-year-old and a 17-year-old are as different from each other as the 17-year-old is from an adult.
Very true. The study really highlights that transition. It's one of the largest single-center series we have now, and it confirms that while the surgery is challenging, the outcomes justify the approach.
It's a great contribution to the literature, especially with the 2026 data. It shows that even as technology evolves, the fundamental principles of skull-based surgery, understanding anatomy and the biological behavior of the tumor, remain the same.
Definitely. If anyone wants to dive deeper into the stats or look at the radiographic correlations they found, the paper is Contemporary Series of Transsphenoidal Microsurgery in Pediatric Patients in Neurosurgical Review. Excellent summary, Alara. To our listeners, keep an eye on those pediatric sphenoid sinuses, and don't forget to check the growth charts. Thanks for joining us on the Neurosurgery Hub. We'll see you in the next episode.
Until then, keep learning.